This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the third week of October, and this week Mike Pence went to Turkey and triumphantly announced a ceasefire in Syria. The Turks said they would stop attacking for 5 days, long enough for our one-time Kurdish allies to withdraw from the land Turkey wants to control. And President Trump says because of this, sanctions are no longer needed on Turkey. Previously, Trump had proudly circulated a bizarre letter he apparently sent to Turkish President Erdogan, urging him to, quote, not be a tough guy, unquote, by slaughtering Kurds. Turkish presidential sources told BBC Turkish that Erdogan, quote, threw the letter in the bin, unquote. And before the ceasefire announcement, the House had overwhelmingly voted to condemn the president's decision to precipitously withdraw support for the Syrian Kurds, with two-thirds of Republicans voting with Democrats to oppose the president on the issue. But the White House has framed the ceasefire as a victory, and Senator Lindsey Graham appears to be satisfied, although news reports on Friday said fighting between Kurds and Turks was continuing in Syria. And many Republicans still had objections, wanting to know, we gave Turkey what it had long wanted in northern Syria, and what had we gotten in return? Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left is Dorian Warren, president of Community Change and co-chair of the Economic Security Project. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey there.
Also joining us today is Michael Singh. He is the managing director of the Washington Institute and is the former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council during the George W. Bush administration. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Josh.
So, Mike, the president seemed very proud of this ceasefire announcement. Is this a meaningful achievement?
Well, I think that the ceasefire, if you want to call it that, because the Turks won't call it that, really gave President Trump and President Erdogan sort of what they minimally wanted or needed. You know, President Trump gets this sort of five-day period where the America's Kurdish allies can sort of evacuate this buffer zone so he can maybe rebut the accusations that he abandoned or betrayed this ally. President Erdogan gets relief from sanctions that, had they been pursued sort of to their logical conclusion, could have been quite damaging for the Turkish economy. But it does look like ultimately Turkey gets what it had wanted all along, which is this 30-kilometer deep zone free of the YPG, this Kurdish militia. And if you look at the other fundamentals of the conflict, it really does nothing to address the bigger problems caused by the American withdrawal. You know, the resurgence of ISIS, the movement of the Assad regime and its backers, Russia and Iran, into eastern Syria, and really sort of the deterioration of American influence over the outcome there.
Rich, Mitt Romney took the Senate floor shortly after the announcement of this ceasefire to raise a number of objections to the president's Turkey policy. And here is one particular point that he made.
Are we so weak and so inept diplomatically that Turkey forced the hand of the United States of America? Turkey?
This is a remarkable thing here, right? That if we were going to do this, it seems like we should have, you know, first figured out what we wanted from the Turks and other relevant parties in the region in exchange for deciding to withdraw the support that we had been offering to the Kurds, if we thought that was a good idea at all. And I feel like we've seen a repeat of a pattern that we've seen with President Trump's so-called negotiating in a number of areas, where instead of considering a concession and saying, what can I get from you for this concession? Simply handing out the concession and then thinking that that gives him a chit that he's able to call in later, whether it's from Erdogan or whether it's from Chairman Kim in North Korea. Basically, the idea like, look, I gave you this nice summit. You should do something to help me out. This is not an effective negotiating strategy, and it puts us in this bizarre position where we're basically having to threaten and beg the Turks because we gave up some of the power that we had in this region.
Yeah, at this point, it's all about mitigating the downside, and I think Romney's point has a lot of force. Now, the more sophisticated Trump defenders on the right will say, look, we only had 50 guys there, and Erdogan was dead set on going in, and we don't want to dispute with a NATO ally, and we only had 50 guys. Well, one, we only had 50 guys because that's the number that Trump wanted right there. And two, we have tripwire forces around this, like this around the world. You know, in South Korea, we had them, you know, during the Cold War holding Berlin. And what you do in this instance is say, you're going to kill Americans, and if you kill an American, we'll destroy your economy, what Trump, you know, tweeted afterwards. And you certainly would have stayed Turkey's hand, at least in the short term, and then you could try to negotiate something out. Now you're negotiating something out from a point of weakness. Now, the ceasefire is a good thing. If there could be some stabilizing longer-term agreement on that on the border, that'd be a good thing. But the larger picture is a fairly catastrophic one. Because, like, as I said of NATO during the Cold War, the point was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, the Americans in. The point of the arrangement we had in northeastern Syria was to keep the Americans in, to keep Assad out, to keep Russia out, and keep the Iranians out, and keep ISIS down. And if we're going totally out, we're going to be out, and the question then is whether ISIS really stays down, because Russia will not be nearly as motivated to do that. We've seen that in the rest of Syria as we have been, and that's the huge strategic downside potential here.
Dorian, to the extent Republicans have been divided on this, there's been pretty close to unanimity among Democrats, with the possible exception of Tulsi Gabbard, as to what should be done here in Syria. And I think it's an interesting contrast to what Democrats have to say about Afghanistan and talking about the importance of getting out of Afghanistan. There seems to be a pretty strong commitment to whatever level of commitment it was that we had in Syria among Democrats. And that's even though the Obama administration was quite indecisive about Syria over the years, about the level of commitment that we were willing to make to achieve goals in Syria. Is this purely about the limited nature of the mission that we've had in Syria, the specific focus on keeping ISIS at bay? That's why there's this consensus around, you know, we should have kept this position in Syria, even in a political party that is generally been sort of skeptical of these long-term foreign commitments?
Yeah, the Democratic Party foreign policy has its own contradictions, but this is a place where there is bipartisanship that we're seeing in the last week, right? And so when you have someone like a Michael Gerson come out in the Washington Post and say that the president's foreign policy is ignorant of history, driven by impulse, immune to advice, dead to the romance of American ideals, that's not me. That is the former speechwriter for George W. Bush. This is about betraying our friends, betraying the Kurds. This is about devaluing and abandoning, you know, our commitments to the Middle East. And by giving, we just gave Erdogan a free hand in Syria. Putin is going to increase his presence in the Middle East. This is a total disaster. And it's not just Democrats saying this. Tulsi Gabbard, by the way, is an exception to the rule here. This is about Republicans and Democrats at a consensus in the Republican Party, frankly, in terms of many of the foreign policy experts who agree with Democrats on this issue. So this is like the rare point of bipartisanship all week long. If I could just make this plain, Josh, this would be like the ceasefire is like if I crash into your car, I get out, I pour gasoline on it, I light it on fire, I watch it burn, I call the fire department, and then I say, thank God I saved your car. That is that's the barbershop explanation of what just happened this week.
Mike, what should we expect going forward regarding ISIS here? I mean, we've seen these news reports about ISIS prisoners escaping in chaos that surrounds the attacks on the Kurds and the Kurdish withdrawal from certain positions. It would seem like everybody in the area who's not ISIS would have at least some incentive to keep ISIS contained, given the chaos and destruction and death that they cause. Is Rich right that that we're replacing a partner that was committed to controlling ISIS with others that will continue to allow ISIS to rise again?
He is right. And unfortunately, stopping ISIS has often not been the top priority of our partners in the region. In a sense, ISIS is really a symptom of the deeper conflicts that we have seen in the region. It emerged not at the outset of the Syrian conflict in 2011, but only after there had been this vacuum of governance, a vacuum of authority in that part of Syria. And so we're afraid that's what's going to happen again. That, you know, before, you had our Kurdish partners, our Arab partners in eastern Syria sort of guarding these ISIS prison camps. And, you know, this was already a tenuous situation. We already saw ISIS beginning to reemerge as an insurgency, essentially, in eastern Syria. And the worry is that now this will breathe sort of new oxygen into the reemergence of ISIS, that they'll break out of the prisons, that they'll start conducting attacks within the cities of eastern Syria. And you'll really see a reemergence of this group as a threat to the United States. And this sort of gets to the question you were just asking, Dorian. Look, if you don't like endless war, and if you didn't like the Iraq war, you should actually really like this American deployment to Syria that we're now sort of tossing to the side, because you had essentially just a few hundred American operators, special forces, that had rallied this 60 to 70,000 strong local partner force that was actually doing a pretty good job of keeping the peace in that part of the world and of sort of staving off a threat to the United States. That's a model which we should like, that is more sustainable than those sort of wars we've seen in the past. And unfortunately, it sort of withdrawing those troops, I think we're going to find that they weren't sort of part of an endless war. They were there sort of keeping the peace and maintaining a rough stability.
I was just going back to the point about Democrats and Obama and his foreign policy. if you hate what Trump's doing now, you have to oppose the way Obama handled Syria as well, because his policies basically was have zero significant influence on the ground. To stand aside while Assad committed atrocities on a scale nothing like Turkey is going to do here. And he affirmatively invited Russia into Syria. So my problem with what Trump is doing now is it represents a commonality with the worst parts of Obama's foreign policy rather than a break from it.
Well, although I think I think nobody really loved the Obama foreign policy.
I'm not going to defend that, Rich.
But I mean, it was Obama's foreign policy,
right? But I think you know we all should have learned some lessons from that, and it seemed like we all did learn some lessons from that on both sides of the aisle until the president went and did this, and he had this meeting at the White House this week about Syria with Republicans and Democrats from Capitol Hill, which we'll talk about at more length later. But one thing the president apparently said in that meeting about these ISIS prisoners is, well, they're 7,000 miles away. Right. And so that's somebody else's problem, which I find to be a stunning thing to say on a number of levels. I mean, one is a moral level about, oh, these people are going to go out and kill people and do terrorism and we don't care because it's far away. But also, it doesn't have to stay far away. Liz Cheney, of all people in this meeting, pointed out to him, you know, the September 11th attackers started out 7,000 miles away and they came here. So I find that to be an amazing moral position for the president to take. But I also find it to be a shockingly risky political position for him to take.
Right,
I mean, what if something happens here? What is his plan for that? I mean, I guess his plan is to blame somebody else, but I'm not sure that that's going to work politically.
So a couple things. First of all, it also slights the great effort that's undertaken to capture these people in the first place with blood and treasure.
An effort largely conducted by the Kurds.
Correct. And two, it's just our experience has been anytime these extremist groups get some significant safe haven with some period of time and enough breathing space, they will come after us. And that was the whole point of Trump's campaign against the caliphate and destruction of the caliphate, which was a great victory and was based on the idea, well, the caliphate's 7,000 miles away, but it's going to be a threat to us eventually if we let it stay here. So this is throwing away what was a success. I think unappreciated success. He didn't get enough credit for it at the time, but it's throwing it away and undermining what the rationale for it was in the first place as well.
Not only makes us less safe, it diminishes American power and ideals in the world, which I thought Republicans and conservatives in terms of foreign policy were always advocating. And I do think this is an area. Again, I don't know who I am this morning. This is an area of bipartisanship, right? There is much more consensus around foreign policy across the parties on this issue than on almost every single thing else we're going to talk about.
You know, and I think that if there's a lesson from Syria, this goes back to what Rich was saying, it's that you can't really contain these issues. You know, I mean, since 2011, sort of America has been trying to ignore what was happening in Syria or to cauterize it or to contain it, to use some of the language of the past. But you can draw a straight line from this Syrian conflict to the rise of far-right politics in Europe, to Brexit, to the sort of destabilization that we have seen across the Middle East, to sort of, you know, Al-Qaeda gaining new strength in places like Idlib. And you find that our efforts to ignore it have really failed. And I think that we'll find that again, unfortunately, in the future, that you simply can't hope that this will remain a far-off tragedy.
Mike, what do you make of the president's relationship with Turkey and with Turkish President Erdogan? Because Erdogan seems to be who has gotten exactly what he wanted out of this. And then the story is happening at the same time that we're learning more about various financial links into the Trump administration and to people close to the president from Turkey. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, had represented Reza Zarrab, this criminal defendant in the U.S. who ultimately got convicted for matters related to circumventing U.S. sanctions on Iran, which you would think would be a signature policy for the presidents, but he sort of acceded to Turkish requests or tried to accede to Turkish requests to slow walk certain prosecutions related to that. We'd held back on prosecuting this Turkish bank, Halk Bank, also for sanctions-related matters until this week when the president got mad that Erdogan was basically making Trump look bad. And so then we finally indicted this Turkish bank. You've had people close to the president lobbying, trying to extradite Fethullah Gulen from the United States, this cleric who's a political enemy of Erdogan. I find it sort of inexplicable, and I look toward these financial explanations to explain how Turkey, which has become an increasingly malevolent power, has gotten so much direct influence over this president.
Well, you know, I sort of understand how people might be inclined to connect those dots, Josh, but I actually see this as more of a sort of just a difficult foreign policy problem than anything that I would regard as a conspiracy of sorts. And I mean, the reality is that, you know, since President Erdogan took power in Turkey, since he was elected prime minister and then elected president, increasingly there's been this drift between the United States and Turkey. There's been a drift of Turkey away from the Western alliance. Turkey would say that's in part because they feel as though they were rejected by the EU and they were sort of pushed away. But we have found that sort of basically sort of trying to reconcile Turkey's status as a NATO ally with its actions both domestically and in the region has been difficult. And both President Obama and President Trump have tried to use a sort of personal connection with President Erdogan to try to smooth over those differences or to try to pull the Turks back into our orbit. And if there's anything this recent incident shows, it's that those efforts have not really been successful. That in fact, this drift continues and will really cast a shadow now over Turkey's membership in NATO.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Dorian Warren of Community Change and the Economic Security Project, and Mike Singh of the Washington Institute to talk about Ukraine. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dorian Warren of Community Change and the Economic Security Project. And still with us is Mike Singh of the Washington Institute. And we are also now joined by Kelly Goff, columnist for the Daily Beast. Hello, Kelly.
Hey, Josh.
So it was a chaotic week at the White House, and not just because of the rapidly evolving Syria situation. The president called congressional leaders to a meeting about Syria, which Democrats stormed out of after he called Nancy Pelosi a third-rate politician, or maybe it was a third-grade politician. There were conflicting reports about that. And acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney gave a hell of a press conference where he seemed to admit to a quid pro quo that the president was holding back military aid to Ukraine because he wanted them to investigate something about the DNC server in the 2016 election, whether it was in Ukraine or whatever. Then hours later, Mulvaney issued a statement saying he hadn't said that at all and the unfair media was being unfair and imputing that to him. Mulvaney also mentioned in passing they're going to have the G7 summit at President Trump's own resort down in Florida next year. So, Rich, Mulvaney said, at least until he walked it back a few hours later, the White House withheld military aid because they wanted to pressure Ukraine to help the president chase this conspiracy theory. We're not in impeachable offense territory for you?
No. I think over the last week, what we've learned, one, is just sort of underlying stuff we already knew, which is that foreign policy professionals around this process were freaked out and appalled by that phone call. And they're freaked out and very worried that Rudy Giuliani was running his own foreign policy in Ukraine. What Mulvaney lifts the skirt on a little bit is I'm sure that Trump was talking to people about, yeah, I'm squeezing them. I'm going to get to the bottom of the 2016 thing. I'm going to nail the corrupt Bidens. You know, that's not where Mulvaney said that didn't come up, but you got to believe it did. But he also, Mulvaney, something that's been neglected, he talked about the legality of withholding the funds in an internal debate whether they could even do it. And I think the best defense of the administration is improper to raise the Bidens on the call, improper to think about doing this. But ultimately, they didn't do it. And we also saw via Byron New York, a reporter with the Washington Examiner, a fuller account of Kurt Volker's deposition. All these depositions so far have been secret. And Schiff and Volker are going back and forth. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the committee, and Kurt Volker are going back and forth about this quid pro quo. And Volker's like, the Ukrainians didn't know. They didn't know. I was in the middle of it. They had no idea. And by the time the money was released, they dropped the idea of doing what they were getting pressured to do, which is make a statement they were doing these investigations. So I think the best case is improper. We shouldn't have done it. Shouldn't have thought about doing it, but we didn't effectuate it.
This has come up repeatedly, a defense of essentially the president is too dumb to do the things that he was trying to do. And so that's a defense, which I'm not sure it is. I think intent matters here. And if you intend to do something corrupt, even if you screw it up.
Well, I think an analogy would be there are all these stories about how, and we saw more of it in the Mueller report, he was pressuring Don McGahn or pressuring various people, had various schemes to fire Robert Mueller and never did. So do you impeach him because he thought about doing this and was talked about it out of it and ultimately didn't do it? To me, that seems Well, but the wrong standard.
If you had the legal standard for conspiracy, a conspiracy doesn't have to be successful to be a crime. You just have to have an agreement to the conspiracy, and there has to be an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. And I think both of those would be met.
Also, the severity of what you're talking about. So, if it's a murder conspiracy and you don't carry it out, and you really wanted to murder someone, that's at a level. If you're just thinking about it, is the horrible thing. But if you're the president of the United States and you're just squeezing a foreign power the way presidents do all the time, with intentions that aren't great, it doesn't seem to me that rises the level of impeaching and removing a president 12 months from office, as I say every single time.
But stupidity isn't a defense for the rest of us who are average folks, right? Like if I screw up on my taxes and I say, but I really didn't know that I had to pay...
Well, that can be a defense in tax crimes often.
It is absolutely a defense, yeah. And a lot of people end up in prison anyway, even though they tried that defense. I just had no idea. I have a couple thoughts on this. The first being that I'm starting to really wonder if Mulvaney just wants to join Sean Spicer on Dancing with the Stars, and he's doing whatever he can humanly possible to get fired without having to actually quit this job. There was just a new, as of 2 months ago, the American public was not buying this. There was not widespread support for impeachment. Gallup just released a poll that shows that the numbers are actually higher than they were for supporting impeaching Bill Clinton. And they're heading towards the territory of a majority of Americans feeling that supporting impeachment as supported it under Richard Nixon. So clearly, despite the best attempts of the White House, who's not only splitting hair to this point, I would say splitting hair follicles, like listening to Mulvaney go back and forth with, and I want to give a shout out here to Ayesha Rasko, because whoever has not seen her questioning, her dogged pursuit of Mulvaney and really nailing him down in his words, please go to her Twitter page and watch that, because it needs to be seen. That's what real journalism looks like in an age where everyone's complaining about fake news. I don't know that this is going to hold up. I think that we're at a tipping point that's actually worse for this president than whatever he was attempting to do to the Biden family, where even people who don't fully follow the ins and outs of whatever the three amigos did or did not do, and that's, Volker, Perry,
and Gordon Sondland.
And Gordon Sondland, people are starting to buy that there was something that does not smell clean. And even if they can't pin down exactly what the intent was or if it was successful, people understand a basic fact that you learn in high school government, which is that government of the United States is not supposed to be for sale to a political government for political reasons.
Yeah, so, Mike, what do you make of Mulvaney's essential defense there? I mean, he even literally used the phrase get over it, but he basically said, look, there's always political horse trading in diplomacy, and that basically this was normal. Is that plausible to you? Is what was going on here normal in the ordinary course of business?
Well, it is right that we often tie foreign assistance to sort of things we want governments to do, whether that's human rights questions. Sometimes it is things like anti-corruption. Generally, those things are legislated by Congress, and oftentimes those things are opposed, frankly, by the executive branch. So you see this in the case of Egypt, for example, where, we have certain security imperatives that we pursue with Egypt, and oftentimes Congress tries to put a bit of a break on those and say, well, you can't give that assistance unless Egypt takes actions A, B, and C related to human rights. So these types of sort of conditionality is what we typically call them, do exist, but typically they're, of course, related to other foreign policy goals that we might have that might conflict with the purpose of the aid, and so we're trying to balance different goals.
Can I just say that what Mike said was so important, which is it's about policy, not politics. And that's what Mulvaney has really opened a can of worms about, because he keeps trying to, what he said to Ayesha Rasko is that it was about the DNC server, and that should be acceptable. It had nothing to do with the Bidens. First of all, I don't think anyone actually buys that. But second of all, even if that's true, that contradicts what Mike just said we traditionally our presidents do, which is it's about policy and not political dirt.
Well, and also it's ordinarily conducted by diplomats, not by the president's personal attorney, whose fiduciary responsibility is not to the United States or the United States government, but to the president personally, and who has been out there on television laying out explicitly what personal goals of the president's he's seeking to serve. And that is what I think is the key distinction. It's fine to use these horse trading negotiations to ask for things for the United States, but when you send your personal employee whose responsibility is to you, and we know the list of things he's asking for, and they're about you, they're not about the U.S., that's where it becomes corrupt.
Well, this is a distinction I would make. So I think when Mulvaney says, You know, we held up foreign aid to the Northern Triangle countries in Central America because we're so concerned about the border. That's a really important political goal of the president, but also overlaps significantly with the public interest. I would say the investigation, the DNC server thing is crazy, but the investigation into what the origin of the 2016 Russia investigation, I think there's a public interest in that. So it'd be legitimate to squeeze the Ukrainians on that. Where it's out of bounds is the Bidens. And what also is out of bounds, Jeff, what you're getting at, is Rudy. And when I say some of the things we're learning, there's underlying things we already knew, that's the huge black box. And it's potential these players are funneling money to him, and he was whispering their agenda into the ears of the president, like this ambassador is terrible. And that is also something that, you know, I've said generally the facts are going to get worse in this thing. I fear the facts are going to get much, much worse on Rudy in particular.
Look, the incompetence, the sloppiness, the mediocrity on display here is indefensible. Just full stop. And Mulvaney talking out of two sides of his mouth yesterday is just embarrassing and stunning. There are cracks right now in those who have enabled this president. There are cracks. They've been testifying before Congress. We're going to be hearing much more from this. And let's not get into the legal particularities here about impeachment. This is a political thing. And I think it's slowly dawning on the GOP how badly Nancy Pelosi is actually dancing circles around them on this. She's moving fast to make sure this thing is long over before the election, which means that either Trump is gone or the grievance politics are going to favor the Democrats. And so if I'm Mitch McConnell right now, I'm really worried about this, the kind of position this puts someone like Susan Collins in Maine into, because either she's going to enrage Trump supporters, depending on her position, or she's going to mobilize the Democratic base. And this is a no-win scenario. So what this president has done actually puts the Republican hold on the Senate at play now.
I kind of wonder, the conventional wisdom was that good for the Democrats to go fast. Mm-hmm. I kind of wonder now. I think it might be good for Trump if they go fast, because this story is not ending until he's impeached and acquitted. That's what's going to happen. And the sooner it happens, and if it happens before the end of the year, it's good for him. It'll be forgotten in a couple of weeks. But if polling is accurate and shows that above 50%, it's a popular initiative, and maybe Democrats should stretch it out. The problem, though, is like when you get into election year, does that change because you get closer to the election?
I actually disagree with both of you. I actually think it could be impeachment could be bad for Democrats for a completely different reason, which is that if Donald Trump actually is successfully impeached and it's before the election, the primary reason to vote for Democrats is now taken off the table.
You mean if he's removed from office?
If he's removed from office, or if it looks like it's happening. If
that's
it looks like, or if it looks like it's happening, because if the argument is we may be all mediocre candidates, but at least we're better than that guy, and that guy is off the table, and you're looking at Mike Pence, evangelical voters are happy and they're motivated.
First of all, he's not going to be removed, but if he was, it would be read by half of the party or more as a vicious betrayal of 20 Republican insiders of this great champion, Donald Trump. The party would be ripped apart and would definitely lose in 2020. Its chances of winning would plummet rather than increase.
Yeah, I think Rich is right. The circumstance in which Donald Trump has been removed from office is a circumstance where the Republican Party, where the president's numbers have deteriorated so badly that they decide they're better off going through the civil war of removing him than keeping him in place.
The civil war is
and then the party is so focused on fighting each other.
But that's what I think. I think you guys are not being completely clear here. I'm not just talking about if Democrats take him out. I'm saying that if Dorian's partially right, which is that he is sinking the rest of the party, I think that everyone's underestimating both Mike Pence and his wife, Karen, who is very much underestimated as a political strategist in terms of deciding he's dead weight for the party, and they find a way to have clean hands on pushing him off the political cliff. And I think that if that happens, it makes it a lot harder to say that if you're a woman, you need to vote against Donald Trump this election, because Donald Trump is no longer the same issue. So I think there's a big question mark there about whether or not Nancy Pelosi and everyone will continue dancing.
Yeah, but Kelly, my point was actually shifting away a little bit from the presidential politics of this to the internal war that will destroy the Republican Party. There is a reckoning coming. And particularly if you think about Senate control, everybody was saying that the Republicans were going to easily keep the majority in the Senate. I think that's up for grabs now. From Mitch McConnell, He must be upset with the president right now for putting him in this really tight spot, because he's going to have to force his moderate, vulnerable members to take really tough votes.
Well, actually, so I have a question for Mike about that, the Republicans in Congress being uncomfortable, because I think about this meeting they had at the White House and this photo that the president shared on social media, thinking it made him look good, where Nancy Pelosi has stood up and is pointing her finger at him and he appears to be yelling. Mike, I was looking at the faces of all the Republicans around that table. You couldn't see Mitch McConnell in the frame of the photo, and Mitch McConnell avoided making any comments on the meeting after he came out. I assume he sort of faded into the wallpaper somewhere. But the Republicans in that meeting did not look happy. You know, if you imagine a meeting like that in the White House with the president basically saying he doesn't care what happens to the ISIS prisoners because they're 7,000 miles away, how are Republicans on the Hill going to react to that sort of thing?
Well, I think we've seen how they've reacted. I mean, there is tremendous frustration with the way, especially the Syria decision, has gone down, because Republicans are concerned about ISIS. They're concerned about Iran. They're concerned about Russia. I mean, these are things which the ordinary sort of congressman, Republican congressman on the Hill, cares a lot about. And that's, I think, why you saw that bipartisan vote to condemn the decisions that the administration has made on Syria. And, you know, if we go back to the Ukraine issue, this is also a foreign policy issue, and we shouldn't forget that. You know, this is in part we see the politicization of foreign policy, which didn't start under the Trump administration. It's been something that has been a creeping issue, I would say, over the past several administrations. And then we also see potentially the undermining of some real sort of foreign policy goals the United States has had in Eastern Europe. Because remember, corruption was one of the vectors, is one of the vectors that Russia is attempting to use to sort of extend its own influence in these places. And if this sort of undermines our efforts to combat that, if it undermines our efforts to strengthen vulnerable states like Ukraine, then we have lost not just sort of whatever we're losing here in the domestic political sense, but it's a foreign policy loss as well.
Can we talk about the G7, Trump Doral? President, I guess, decided this would be a good week to announce that he's going to have the G7 summit at his own resort in South Florida in June, because who doesn't love going to Miami in June? Rich, I've been interested watching Republicans react to this. I mean, some have just sort of easily said, no, this is not appropriate. Lisa Murkowski said you shouldn't do this. But then you had Marco Rubio saying, well, he's happy when these sorts of things come to Miami. And you had Senator Kramer from North Dakota basically saying, well, you know, what law can you point me to that this is in violation of? Why is the party carrying the president's water on this obviously inappropriate thing that he's doing that produces no benefit to Republicans as a whole, just to him personally?
Fear. It's fear that he's watching everything they say and that he might tweet at them and make their life really difficult or potentially destroy their career if he makes it a little cause of his. But it's clearly inappropriate. And whatever Mulvaney was saying is going to be at cost, he's going to make no money, it's still clearly inappropriate and gross and wrong, and he shouldn't do it.
This is just like it's like looting the treasury and profiteering off the office of the presidency in public, in plain view. There's just like there's no mincing of words about this. It is what it is. This is unacceptable behavior from an American president, and everybody has to say so. This is a breaking of another norm, which he has done over and over and over again, and we have now accepted it as just, oh, okay, well, this time he's just going to host the G7 and profit from it, even though it's actually unconstitutional.
I just think the bar is so low, and I think I hate admitting this, but I do think there's a bit of Trump scandal fatigue, meaning,
exactly.
You know, after the Access Hollywood tape, there were a lot of really credible allegations that came from other women. You know, he forcibly kissed me while I was working for him. He did this. And I think because he had said on a tape that, you know, I can sexually assault women and get away with it, people were sort of like, we've heard it, you know, and that's not good. That's actually terrible. But I do think that's part of what's going on with the reaction to the story.
Let's leave that there. I want to thank Mike Singh of the Washington Institute for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with Dorian Warren of Community Change and the Economic Security Project, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. We will be back to talk about the fourth Democratic presidential debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dorian Warren of Community Change and the Economic Security Project. And still with us is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. The fourth Democratic presidential debate was this Tuesday, and it was the first debate since Joe Biden's son, Hunter, got an involuntary starring role in the campaign. President Trump and Rudy Giuliani have been spinning elaborate and invented criminal conspiracy theories about Hunter's business activities in Ukraine. But all that nonsense is built around a real issue at the core that isn't about crimes. It's that Hunter Biden took a seat on a board of a Ukrainian company, earning hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, that he never would have gotten if his last name weren't Biden at the time his father was making policy toward Ukraine, likely because that company thought Hunter Biden's presence gave them at least the appearance of influence with American politicians. Here's how Joe Biden addressed that issue at Tuesday's debate.
Hold on. Sorry, I just want to follow up. Mr. Vice President, as you said, your son Hunter today gave an interview, admitted that he made a mistake and showed poor judgment by serving on that board in Ukraine. Did you make a mistake by letting him? You were the point person on Ukraine at the time, if you can answer.
Look, my son's statement speaks for itself. I did my job. I never discussed a single thing with my son about anything having to do with Ukraine. No one has indicated I have. We've always kept everything separate. Even when my son was the attorney general of the state of Delaware, we never discussed anything. So there'd be no potential conflict. My son made a judgment. I'm proud of the judgment he made. I'm proud of what he had to say. And let's focus on this. The fact of the matter is that this is about Trump's corruption. That's what we should be focusing on.
Dorian, is that answer good enough?
No, it's not. And it's indefensible. Look, this is why Americans are so down on government, right? And especially in Washington, because what happened here is someone was well connected and got perks and got to benefit from daddy, right? And so you have to be critical whenever this occurs, no matter the party. And so I am very, very disappointed in Vice President Biden. That's a non-answer. He didn't take it head on. And so you should be just as angry at Hunter Biden and Joe Biden as you should be with the Trump kids, who are also benefiting from daddy's connections, right? This is bipartisanship at its worst, in a sense, right? Of well-connected, powerful people and their children benefiting when their children haven't earned it.
Well, I think that, you know, Dorian makes a very valid point, which is whether it's the Bushes, whether it's the Kennedys, whether it's the Obamas, right? Because there are internships that the Obama's oldest daughter landed that I'm sure it didn't hurt who her father was, right? And so I think that's part of the big frustration in terms of class inequality in this country. But I'm not really sure what Vice President Biden was supposed to say, because it's not illegal for someone to give an Obama daughter an internship, or a Biden son, or a Trump kid a job or an internship because of who their parents are. The question becomes whether or not the job itself then ends up leading to illegal activity.
I think there's a distinction here, though, with like the Obama internships, which it's not so much about that, like someone was hiring Malia Obama to create the appearance of influence with the U.S. administration. Nobody was paying her $600,000 a year. I mean, I think, you know, presidents have families. They're going to do something. They are famous. They're going to be more in demand. I think there's a distinction between that and going and serving on a foreign corporate board.
Yes.
Which is also what
one of the Bush sons did. And so what I'm saying is I'm in fundamental agreement with Dorian that it's problematic, and it's part of why people do have a problem with politicians, because a lot of the ones who say they care about class inequality perpetuate it by making sure their kids get to the front of the line, whether it's in college admissions, whether it's internships, whether it's jobs. The thing I do want to take a moment to say, though, is I think it's something that hasn't been spoken about publicly, and I've certainly had private conversations. I was very moved watching the interview with Hunter Biden, because I don't know if it confirmed for me that Joe Biden is the best candidate this election cycle. It confirmed for me he's a really great dad, because Hunter Biden was asked repeatedly whether or not he was worried about hurting his father's electoral chances. And he kept saying, my dad doesn't care about that. My dad loves me, and that's not what he's focused on. And I think it'd be great if every person had a parent who loved them that much. What I would say, though, is I think one of the things that's not being talked about in terms of Biden's candidacy, because I don't think anyone can make the case that he's been at his best this campaign. And, you know, like a lot of Americans, I've had people in my life who've struggled with addiction. And I think one of the questions people have to start wondering, I don't know a single person who's had a family member who's dealt with addiction who would say that year was the year they were at their best. And my question is really whether or not Joe Biden can be the best candidate he can be when he's this worried as anyone who's related to someone battling addiction the way Hunter is. If you can run the best campaign of your life. And I I have such compassion for him. But that's really the question for me. Watching Hunter Biden, this is someone who's very, very close. I mean, they're very in the early stages of newfound sobriety again. And so I worry what this story's doing to him, just as a human being. I worry what it's doing to his father. And that means I have to worry what this is doing to the candidacy. And I think anyone who doesn't want to see Donald Trump reelected, that's to me more of a question mark than Joe Biden's age.
Yeah, I mean, there was that big New Yorker profile of Hunter Biden back in the summer that looked like an effort basically to get out all of the stories about Biden, not just the Burisma board thing, but, you know, the discharge from the Navy for testing positive for cocaine and the affair with his brother's widow and all of these other things. And it's like it's a very affecting personal story. It almost feels invasive. I shouldn't have to know about all this Biden family drama. It shouldn't be a relevant matter. But Hunter has made it one through this Burisma activity. The other personal stuff could just be, well, that's, you know, people have people like this in their families. This is where it got it, where it ended up affecting Joe Biden's professional responsibilities. Even if, and I believe Biden when he says, you know, my actions regarding Ukraine were not influenced by what Hunter was doing. And, you know, the things that Biden was doing very publicly about Ukraine were things that had bipartisan support, support from Republican senators. I don't think that Biden's own activities were untoward. And frankly, I think Biden is not forcefully enough defending his own record on Ukraine. I don't think Hunter's actions are defensible. I think Joe Biden's actions are. And it worries me that he can't stick up more for that. But I think a lot of Democrats are failing to keep two ideas in their head, which are, the Trumps are much worse than this. Like people, you know, it is extremely rich for Don Jr. to be out there talking about how inappropriate it is for Hunter Biden to have been trading on the Biden family name. And if you were a single issue family related corruption voter and it is a Biden versus Trump election, you should vote for Biden.
There's some of them out there. There's one of them out there.
But at the same time, what Hunter did wasn't okay. And it's a thing that people, you know, this sort of corruption, and it is corruption even when it's not a crime, is a thing that voters worry about for good reason, and Democrats should be able to get a clean advantage on this and say, we're the party that is against this sort of thing, and Hunter gets in the way of that.
I'm just saying that in the list of things—
Let's get Richard.
I was going to say, I thought Biden's answer was subpar for two reasons. One, in front of a sympathetic Democratic audience and something you're prepared for and you know it's coming, this should have been a home run of righteous indignation. You know, leave my family out of it. Mm. And it just didn't rise to that level. But then two, it was bad because it's kind of complicated. So he says, I'm proud of my son's judgment. The night that the interview airs where his son says, this was really poor judgment. I shouldn't have done it. So how do you get around it? And just to Kelly's point about the affecting element of Hunter Biden's interview with ABC, what kind of brought it home to me is when he was asked, you know, do you fear for your sobriety being under this pressure? And that just brings home, like, we all talk at this certain level for abstraction for all the players, this kind of blood sport. But that's like a very human thing. You know, someone's life could be, you know, drastically affected for the worst by this political debate.
Let's talk about some of the policy.
I could be compassionate, though, for Hunter, for sure. I think that interview evoked compassion, but I could still be angry over what's frankly the opportunity hoarding of the rich and well-connected and powerful in both parties. Like, that is the thing that's infuriating for me. And I thought Joe Biden should have been much stronger. I do agree with you on this point, Rich. This should have been a home run. He should have said, no, this is wrong, and I plan to stop it because I'm not going to come in at the standard. I'm going to set the standard.
Speaking of power hoarding, let's talk about the way they talked about billionaires and wealth at this debate. They sort of had an argument over the wealth tax, although they didn't really. The candidates who are not for a wealth tax never really explained why they weren't for a wealth tax, other than saying, you know, well, there's lots of ideas about how to tax the rich. But here's what Elizabeth Warren did have to say about why she's in favor of her wealth tax plan.
So understand, taxing income is not going to get you where you need to be the way taxing wealth does. That the rich are not like you and me. The really, really billionaires are making their money off their accumulated wealth, and it just keeps growing. We need a wealth tax in order to make investments in the next generation. Look, I understand that this is hard, but I think as Democrats, we are going to succeed when we dream big and fight hard, not when we dream small and quit before we get started.
Oh, I would like to respond to that.
So, Dorian, is a wealth tax about revenue generation, or is it about reducing the concentration of wealth? Because it seems to me that those goals are somewhat at odds. The better your tax does at abolishing billionaires, the less revenue it's going to generate.
I think it's both and. I don't think those are mutually exclusive, Josh. It is about raising revenue, for sure, from a Democratic point of view, for funding public goods that are accessible to everyone, whether it's clean water or childcare, whatever it is. But it's also about inequality. Now, remember, in 2018, for the first time, the 400 richest households paid a lower tax rate than the rest of us. This is a violation of the Warren Buffett rule, right? Where he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. And so that's just a basic principle of fairness. And there's something that seems wrong, and Americans overwhelmingly agree that something is wrong with our country, because it's not unrelated to the previous question, right, around opportunity hoarding, or the previous topic, right? And if you're born rich, you get all sorts of perks. And that's what we're creating with the enormous amount of wealth inequality in this country. At the same time, when 4 out of 10 Americans can't come up with a $400 emergency cash, right? So this is both revenue generation for the programs, right? There was a whole discussion of Medicare for All that we heard and wasn't frankly answered well, I would say, by Elizabeth Warren, even though she stayed on her message. But it's also about fairness and redoing something about inequality in this country.
Kelly, it's interesting to me. A lot of Democrats in the field are not for a wealth tax, and it feels like there are a number of things they could have said about why. They could have said, you know, they don't think it can pass, that they're concerned about economic effects, that they're concerned about these open questions about whether it's constitutional. They look at the experience in other countries, many of which have repealed their wealth taxes. But none of them made those arguments, and it seems to me like a part of a broader pattern where you have the more moderate candidates. They won't explain why they're more moderate, which I find weird, because if you can't say why you're not for this idea that people in your base like, then why aren't you just for the idea?
Because they don't want to say it in front of their base. They think they can win in the general if they can just not talk about it in front of the base, because it's not popular with certain moderates. And the reason it's not popular, and I mean moderates and swing voters, and the reason it's not popular is the thing that you're not supposed to say out loud. If you are someone who doesn't define yourself as conservative — I don't consider myself a conservative, I'm a registered independent — which is defining wealth in New York and Manhattan, where I live at the moment, is very different than defining it in Houston, Texas, where I'm from. And so what people don't like to talk about is that someone who can be very rich and living very large in one place is barely getting by in San Francisco or Manhattan. And they don't want to upset and offend those people by saying, we're gonna, you know, raise your taxes. Because for people like that, if you're trying to put 4 kids through school in a place that costs more to live, wealth taxes might not be as popular. And I don't think those people are selfish or crazy or unsympathetic to say, I don't want my taxes raised. I'm earning my money and I am not a billionaire. And I'm someone who wants to leave a little something to my kids and have a decent life in San Francisco. That's why they don't want to talk about it in front of their base.
I mean, I think if you're the sort of person with a family income of $200,000 in suburban New Jersey who likes to call yourself middle class, even though that is, you know, you have a high standard of living compared to most people in the country, the wealth tax is not going to hit you. Where that shows up in politics is things like the mortgage interest deduction, the state and local tax deduction, where Democrats, one of their key tax agenda items is repealing this tax increase that was imposed as part of the overall tax cut from Republicans. But if you did that, that's not about Warren Buffett. But the benefits of that do mostly go to these relatively affluent people who are increasingly Democratic voters. I think it's an interesting pressure on the Democratic Party as the base of the Democratic Party gets more affluent, more suburban. What does that mean for tax policy that affects people with pretty high incomes?
I'm going to get hate mail for saying this, but this is, if we're going to talk about numbers, $200,000. If you're making $1 million a year and you have 3 kids who end up in college at the same time and they both get in, and all 3 of them get into really good schools. I went to NYU and Columbia. I had a lot of debt when I graduated. They just did a story on, in terms of the college admission scandal, that some people have been letting their kids emancipate because they had kids who were getting into a school that cost $250,000 a year. If you have more than one kid who gets in, you either say to them, no, you don't get to go to an Ivy, or go to a state school. And for people like that, it sounds like, oh, cry me a river, you know, play the smallest violin. But why is it that that person should say to their kid, no, you can't go to an Ivy because unfortunately we are, quote, middle class at however much we're making a year, but if we could afford to buy a library for $10 million, they'd have no problems going. Those are the face that you're making, though, is exactly why they don't want to talk about this in a Democratic debate.
Yeah. It's a radio show, Kelly.
I think they don't want to talk about it. I think they don't want to talk about it because they don't have a good point. I mean, if you have an income of $1 million a year, you know, you can live your dreams in the United States.
Not but San Francisco.
I want to move off of this. Twitter also came up at the debate. And Kamala Harris, this is a point she's made a lot on Twitter. And then she sort of challenged Elizabeth Warren to say that Twitter should kick President Trump off the platform for breaking Twitter's rules. And Elizabeth Warren more or less ignored her. And then you've seen that it's like the Harris campaign keeps trying to make this happen. And it's just like, you know, I think, you know, you can read the Twitter terms of service and argue, you know, where the president has been breaking them. But I think the broader issue is, you know, the president of the United States gets to speak to the public. And the idea that you're going to contain the president through, you know, the administrative actions of a technology company strikes me as very silly. But I don't know. Does anyone want to stick up for Harris?
Yeah, Harris is just the campaign has been pathetic, and that she thought she was going to have some moment wheeling on Elizabeth Warren on this particular issue was just absurd. Twitter's not going to kick President Trump off, partly for the reason you mentioned, Josh, but also it'd be a huge benefit to President. Everyone in his political team would be in somersaults of joy if he was kicked off Twitter, right? I mean, his approval rating would go up 5 points. Just on the I don't need to say anything on the wealth tax in particular, but you know, made the point that moderates don't. The relative moderates in the race don't challenge these sort of things at the premise, which is true. But we saw more aggression from the likes of Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. And I thought Buttigieg had a particularly good night. I don't think he's ever had a good bad night in any of these debates, except for the one police-involved shooting exchange he had a couple debates back. And he's in double digits in Iowa. So I think it's entirely plausible that Buttigieg could win Iowa, and this race is still more fluid than people think.
Just on this Go point, ahead. Though, about the Kamala attack on Warren, and as well as the Klobuchar and Mayor Pete's attacks on Warren, the data that we're seeing now is that it all seemed to be good news for Elizabeth Warren because she actually gained while under attack. So even all the attacks essentially did not come at her expense, right? Because people focused on her. It reinforced the fact that she's now the front runner. And it gave her more time to respond to the attacks. And camera time with that many people on stage is a pretty big deal at this stage when people are just now forming opinions of the candidates. But to go back to, I want to just say a quick word on Pete and Klobuchar. Look, this is a referendum on structural change versus incremental traditional Washington politics. And it's really hard for me to imagine that the incremental candidates aren't going to run headlong into a very woke Democratic electorate. Now, it's going to be a problem, right, in the general election. But mm-hmm. for Mayor Pete, it's like, just be who you are. Don't go to the middle in desperate hope to catch defections from Biden, because Warren is actually now the second choice of Biden supporters, ironically.
I don't,
and for Klobuchar, being from the Midwest is not a narrative. Hire a better joke writer. Come at the front runners with harsher attacks on their policies and the story they're telling.
Oh, I think if the Amy Klobuchar who showed up at the last debate, it showed up in the previous one, she would be the front runner. But the question is, as we've learned from Kamala Harris, anyone can have one great debate performance. You
yes.
know, Warren yep. has been consistent, and she has been the only one who's been consistent. Now, I think Buttigieg, part of why he had a great night is because he showed she's consistently too liberal to probably actually win, because he couldn't pin her down on Medicare for All because it cost too much. And when The Atlantic published the analysis, what was it, like the very next day, that showed it would cost $34 trillion in additional federal spending, which is more than Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid combined. I mean, that's not someone that a lot of people, including a lot of Democrats, actually are going to want to vote for. So I think Jennifer Rubin nailed it in the Washington Post when she said there's an opening. And I just want to say one last thing on the wealth tax. I think that the moment with Tom Steyer, where he actually said, the only billionaire on stage, I actually agree with Bernie Sanders, was a powerful moment. But here's the thing, is that you can't win a general election by just saying anyone who wants to earn a lot of money is a bad person. A billionaire who has Donald Trump wealth because he's inherited it is not the same as someone who pulled a Tom Steyer and worked really hard and made his own money. And particularly if it's someone who worked really hard and earned $1 to $3 million, which, like I said, even though everyone's going to get mad at me, does not have you rolling in wealth, depending on where you live.
How did you feel, Josh, by the way, after all your ranting against Tom Steyer getting questions that he actually was asked questions during the debate?
Well, he barely had any speaking time, though. I was pleased with the way that, I mean, they couldn't literally ask him no questions, but he had extremely limited speaking time, which I was pleased with, because he should go away. We're going to leave that there on the debate. Kelly Goff, thank you so much for joining us. We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Dorian Warren, what's your rant?
Well, you know, Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg gave a free expression speech at Georgetown this week. And I just have to say, he needs to stop name-checking black people, number one. Please don't call on Frederick Douglass or Dr. King and put yourself in a situation when Dr. King's own daughter basically says to you, no, don't reference my dad. MLK faced disinformation campaigns by politicians, and she argues actually that those disinformation campaigns created an atmosphere for his assassination. He needs to step up and stop defending the power that he has. And so I'm actually really proud that my friend and colleague and his former roommate, the co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, the same day Zuckerberg gives this ridiculous speech, announces an anti-monopoly fund to break up big tech, to break up Facebook, to break up monopolies in this country. So there's an interesting, right? The former co-founders are going to be in a war over the next election cycle. And I think it's time for Facebook to be broken up.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Andrew Yang is winsome and refreshing, but nonetheless a net negative on our public debate because he's feeding unnecessary fear of something we should welcome, namely technology-driven productivity gains, which have been anemic rather than galloping out of control. The focus of our debate should be how to foster greater productivity instead of whipping ourselves into a panic over it.
For my rant, the president has reached a partial trade deal of sorts with China. It's not clear we've gotten much in the way of concessions, though they likely will buy some more soybeans from us and fewer from Brazil. This concession on the part of the president agreeing to this partial deal makes sense. With all of the other trouble he's facing, the last thing he needs is a burgeoning trade war that puts a drag on the U.S. economy. But that's part of why he's such a weak negotiator. The Chinese knew he would have to face re-election and President Xi would not. Since the president waited a year into office to even start the fight with China, they knew they'd be able to run out the clock with him, and they did. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dorian Warren, Mike Singh, and Kelly Goff. Left, Right, and Center was produced this week by Rebecca Mooney. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Tudum Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.